Okay, make sure you're in fellowship as here we return to the text. Genesis chapter 34, where we will see a prime example of the violence of Simeon and Levi, what they were capable of in regards to their lives as part of the heirs of the Abrahamic covenant, that they were not just Pollyanna, rosy glow type of individuals. They had an SCA that obviously is despicable in its actions, in this regards. It begins with a despicable action up front, and that occurs because of what happened to their sister Dinah as she was raped by one Shechem in the area of which they live. Rereading here the verses 1 and 2. Now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. In the Hebrew, the verb went out is at the beginning of the sentence, and then to visit is at the end of the sentence. In verse 2, and when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. So the analysis of verses 1 and 2. One, having pitched his tent at Shechem, per verse chapter 33, verse 18, as he came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram and camped before the city. So having pitched his tent at Shechem, Jacob here has applied God's geographical will per his instructions to return to the land of your fathers, end quote, return to the land of your birth, that is Canaan itself proper, as he's been out of the land, Haran, with his uncle Laban, for some 20 years. That was commanded to him as part of his geographical will in chapter 31, verse 3 and 13. The Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers. And then 13, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, and return to the land of your birth. So God has will expressed with respect to his sovereignty. He has geographical will. That is where he wants the believer to be at any given point in time in their life. Today, his geographical will is for believers to be where sound Bible doctrine is being taught, to make themselves a part of that assembly under their right shepherd in identifying with his voice. So he has conformed and obeyed God in regards to God's geographical will. Two, however, there's a little bit left that he has not applied. He has yet to completely fulfill God's directive will to return, quote, to your relatives, end quote. That was in verse 3, and completing the verse there, not only return to the land of your fathers, the command is twofold. That's number one, my geographical will for you, but also to your relatives and to your relatives. That is a directive will that accommodates the geographical will in the command. And I will be with you. So he has yet to return to his relatives. Three, instead he has established a close residence with Hivites. Verse 36. Canaanite tribe, descendant 6 in the order of Canaan, the son of Ham. Let's see here what chapter that was.
I got that completely messed up. It should be 33:19. And he brought the piece of lamb where he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money.
So they from Canaan. Canaan himself was six in the order, or the Hivites themselves were six in the order of Canaan, which, remembering all the way back, being the son of Ham, as Genesis 10:17. Verse 15, Canaan became the father of Sidon, his firstborn, Heth. 16, Jebusite, the Amorite, the Girgashite. 17, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite. So he's six, and the Hivites are six in that list in the order of Canaan, the son of Ham. So as we saw, they camped. He actually bought real estate. He set up a temple or an altar there for worship pillar. The Hivites, a little background on them, point four. Though they are characterized as a peaceful and commercial people, that's via the Encyclopedia of Biblical Theology, Theological and Ecclesiastical Literature. They were pagans that promoted idolatry, as we will see Genesis 35, 2 and 4 suggest, identifying idolatry with Shechem. God tells him after this scenario to pack up, go to Bethel, make an altar there to God, verse 1, 35, 2. Verse 2, so Jacob said to his household and to all who were with him, put away the foreign gods which were among you, and purify yourselves and change your garments. It looks at the admixture of idolatry that had become entangled in the family during their tenure there in regards to being at Shechem. And then verse 4, so they gave to Jacob all the foreign gods which they had, and the rings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the oak which was near Shechem. And we see this, if you will, identifying these foreign gods with Shechem specifically. Then you compare that to Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5. And you're given a description of the paganistic characters of certain peoples. When the Lord your God shall bring you into the land, this will be in the Exodus via the conquest. Where you are in and possess it, you shall clear away many nations before you, and the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites. They're in the list specifically as part of the Canaanites. The Jebusites, seven nations greater and stronger than you. When the Lord your God shall deliver them before you, verse 2, you shall defeat them, you shall utterly destroy them. They are to be God's wrath, an arm of God's wrath against them, as God is in control of nations. He destroys nations, he builds nations up. You shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them, no pacts of agreement, as allies or otherwise. You're to wipe them out and show them and show no favor to them, without mercy, if you will. Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them. And again, these verses are consistently ripped out of context by people, that God's against interracial marriage. Now, as we'll see in these verses, it's not because of their race. It's because of their spiritual proclivities of being negative and pagan, paganistic, idolaters. You shall not intermarry with them. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. For they will turn your sons away from following me. See? Religious reversionists, that's what they are. And as they were not to associate and embrace them because of that, to serve other gods. Verse 4, then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. But thus you shall do to them, shall tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, and hew down their Asherim, their Baalic gods, and burn their graven images with fire. All their idols. So, the historical recordings of the Hivites, obviously that's after the fact, but it gives you a strong clue that they were already steeped into this type of idolatry, and that's where chapter 35, verses 2 and 4 brings that into focus. Obviously, we know things often get worse as time goes along. But in this case, we can safely conclude that the Hivites were already steeped in idolatry. So this is where Jacob now has landed. He has set up business. He's bought real estate. Obviously, he's still maintaining his own integrity of worship correctly. But he has fallen short in regards to returning all the way back to his relatives in that particular area of Canaan. So five, Jacob's relatives here emphasize his relationships in life. The land, Canaan, emphasizes geography. Relatives emphasizes relationships. Six, the relatives in view here obviously are those like-minded, positive volition, kin relatives, as would be exampled by his parents, Isaac, Rebekah, excluding those negative, believer and unbeliever alike. Now, there's no recording that they ever saw Rebekah again. We know that Jacob was at Isaac's burial with his brother Esau. But the idea here is to return geographically to Canaan and then throw himself in the embrace of like-minded, positive believers who follow the same protocol of worship as they do, as he does. And that would exclude those who are negative, counter-doctrine, whether they're believers or unbelievers. And where do I get that? That's point seven. This principle is inherent in its separation from Laban and Esau that fit the categories of negative volition. As we brought out, Laban was a believer, but he was a reversionist believer. And obviously, his whole idea was to distract and keep Jacob from being in God's geographical will. That was his influence among the other hideous things that he was involved in that regard. And we saw that he was steeped also in religious reversionism, but he was a believer. Esau, his brother, obviously, is an unbeliever. And in both cases, Jacob separates, as we went through all the trouble to detail these things in both of those scenarios. So they become the examples of what he's not to associate with. Not, and both of them were relatives, obviously, but these are not the relatives that God has in mind. Relatives that would be, if you will, like-minded in regards to the covenant and all that it stood for in their worship. So 8 is the doctrine of separation that here underwrites the events that now befall Jacob's house. 9, specifically, failure to separate resulting in the cataclysm of events recorded in our narrative. The doctrine of separation, I don't care how many people want to take issue with it, take pot shots with it. It's in the Bible. It's very clear. I mean, how long is the doctrine? As how many verses are there to document the principle of separation. And it is God's will for positive volition, positive adjust believers, to remain aloof from, separate from, those who otherwise are negative. Doesn't mean that they don't see Him, can't see Him, things of this nature. But they do not embrace Him as their close associates in life, etc. Their friends in life, if you will. And here, the doctrine of separation underwrites the whole scenario of events that occurs. Failure to separate is what brings all this about. So 10, not to diminish the gravity of sins otherwise committed by those concerned. We are to recognize that if separation had been applied, the crimes would not have occurred. If Dinah had stayed home instead of running off into the city of Shechem on her own, the rape would have never occurred. And all that unfolds and results in waves after that, in reaction by the family, all that would have been avoided. So, separation, point 11, is a critical doctrine that determines God's relationship with the believer as good or bad, whether they're in line or out of line, whether a believer is in God's directive will or not, depends in regards to their alliance with the doctrine of separation and applying it in their own lives. And you can, again, people can poo-hoo it, they can water it down, they can say it doesn't apply to me, it doesn't apply to family, and all these other things that you hear in regards to excuses why people continue to embrace the cosmos, continue to hang out with negative volition, and make them their great friends in life, and all these other things. But you still are not going to be able to dance around James 4:4 in regards to our relationships in life. And that is that when you do so, you are not pleasing God. I'll put it just mildly. You are on the adversity side of God. You adulteresses, as spiritual adulteresses, verse 4, James 4, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility towards God? And again, we went through James, and I showed you all the verses in regards to the very construct that is there. The term for world there is only used in this sense in regards to people. So he's dealing with negative volition, see, the reversionist. Therefore, who wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Who you call your friends, who you hobnob with. Well, my situation, it sure limits who I can hang out with because, you know, we're small. Well, so was Noah's family when it was all said and done. 8 of them, see. Obviously, God puts us in situations where we're with those and it can't be avoided. You got to go to school. You got to go to work. So it's not this overreaction thing that people like to try to lay on those who adhere to the doctrine that they're isolationists and things of that nature. All the name calling that goes along with it. But it recognizes that one obviously has their defenses up at all times in regards to people that they're around, especially those who are negative to doctrine. And that they're not the ones that they're going to hobnob with, go party with. See. Yeah, we all go see family on occasion. I understand these things. And you hear the rationale. Doesn't mean that that's who you hang out with. So separation, failure to separate, is what brings all this cataclysm of events to bear here in our chapter. So 12, as we will see, the circumstances of this episode gives maximum opportunity for all involved to fail in doing the right thing. Everyone that's involved in this whole thing fails to some degree, including Dinah, beginning with Dinah, Shechem himself, Hamor, those involved in Shechem involved in the rape, and Hamor his father, and Jacob and Jacob's sons. 13, it has been observed that nobody comes off without sin in this story. Separation is, if you will, an instrument of protection to a certain degree. The principle is the good does not bring up bad. Bad brings down the good, you see. So, obviously, if you hang out with people that don't have concern in regards to embrace people and make them your close camaraderies, comrades in regards to life, and they don't have the same desire, the same goals in regards to spiritual matters in this life, it's going to have a negative effect on you. Everybody applies separation to a certain degree. Even the bleeding heart liberals that say you got to embrace everybody won't embrace us. See? So everybody practices it to be discriminatory, to be choosy and picky in regards to those who you want to hang out with. People that, world obviously, many in the world are negative, but not everybody has good norms and standards. They may, but even then, their norms and standards, as good as they may be, often does not have the spiritual qualities that the doctrine demands. And you get around with somebody, we see how it is, even with the believers who are otherwise positive in life, having like STAs and what they end up doing here. So to have some discernment in regards to our relationships is mandatory to give us maximum protection in life, protect our own spiritual well-being, and you never know how much other trouble it will keep you out of in regards to your life. So 14, the failure to separate here begins with Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had born to Jacob. Dinah, Bathleah, Asher, Yalad, Lamed, Jacob. So 15, now her age at the time is not stated. 16, however, we can conclude she was slightly younger than her half-brother Joseph, who is later to be seen to be 17 years of age, when we get to Genesis 37:2, as we begin the records of the generation of Jacob, it begins with Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock. And we had that whole incident of him being sold into slavery and all these other things. So he's 17 by the time you get to chapter 37. And we know that Leah is slightly younger than her. We figured that out as we did the chronology of all the 11 sons that were born to Jacob with Dinah back in Genesis 30. And that was 17. This is deduced as the Hebrew language of her birth is afterward. That one word, akar, in the Hebrew. In Genesis 30:21. Placing her birth slightly outside of the 7 years allotted for the birth of Jacob's sons. Jacob, through Rachel and Leah, and the two maids, in 7 years had 11 kids, and right outside that window, afterwards, if you will, Leah was born. Shortly afterwards. Joseph was the youngest, so he was born in that seventh year. That was Genesis 30:21.
Leah has all of her sons, and afterwards she bore a daughter and named her Dinah. Verse 21.
That afterward kind of places her birth outside this window of 7 years chronologically.
Then God remembered Rachel. God gave heed to her and opened her womb. She conceived, bore a son, and so we're able to parallel her and put Joseph in that 7 years. Otherwise, God has taken away my reproach. She named him Joseph.
So, 18, now Dinah's full brothers from their mother Leah were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, with the rest being half-brothers from Rachel and the maids, Bilhah and Zilpah, respectively. 19, it is commonly suggested by commentaries that Dinah here was in the range of 13 to 16 years at the time of our episode. So, well, that's kind of a young, see, they get married young back then. Well, the practice was a little bit different, and it is in different societies even today. We tend to wait a little longer. Our attitude is, if you're not an adult, what are you doing getting married? Unless you have to. People obviously mature quicker than others and slower than others. Some of us probably should have stayed single our whole life, but you know how it goes. Because of our lack of maturity is what I'm saying. But anyway. So the common the consensus is among interpreters is that she is somewhere in this neighborhood, 13 to 16. Old enough physically, obviously, to engage in sexual intercourse and have kids and things of that nature, wherever that may land them in the time frame. 20, we can safely conclude she was in her teens, as she is still considered a young girl. Our term yaleda in the Hebrew, which means young maiden, that's in verse 4. Give me this young girl for a wife. And we'll see there's two words used in regards to her age when we get to those verses. One emphasizes her youth, of marriageable age. The other emphasizes her the chronology of her age. She's married. She's married material, young maiden. But anyway, we'll deal with that when we get there. But either way, we know that she is fairly young. She's not over the hill yet. We know that she is old enough to be considered for marriage, as verses 4 and following brings out. And that her brothers were old enough to slaughter a village of men and plunder their goods, taking wives and children as slaves. That's in verses 27 through 29. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in the houses. They're just a few hundred years premature. Later on in life, their offspring will be given the command to go in and do that. You know, basically. But anyway. So 22, now that Joseph was 6 years old when he met his uncle Esau. We figured that out back in chapter 33, verse 7. Trying to keep up with all this stuff. 6 years after the seventh year, of having the kids, and he's Jacob served another 6 years with his uncle Laban before he left, and that's in that year, that time frame, that he then sees Esau, runs into Esau on his way back to the land, and that's when Joseph, all the kids came out and bowed down, and afterward Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. Joseph would have been about 6 years old then. He was a rebuke to the rest of them in his actions, whether he recognized it or not. So that Joseph was 6 years old when he met his uncle Esau. We can surmise that some 10, 11 years spans the time of that event then when they met Esau, with the records of Genesis 37, verse 2. And our event obviously occurs somewhere in that frame of time, in that window of time. So 23, the time end of our event was probably some 8 or 9 years after meeting Esau, that they went and they settled down to buy land, shows some intense of permanency. See, he bought land, Jacob did here, outside the city. So rather than being somewhere just a short time frame after they arrived there, most conclude that they've been there now for several years when all this occurs. So the timing of our event was probably some 8-9 years after meeting Esau, suggesting Jacob had been at Shechem for several years, 7+, at this point. That would then bring the brothers in the age category that you could see them getting involved in a situation like this at this level. 16 to 23 years old, 16 being Joseph. Obviously, this is just best guess. If you think that believing that chronology is going to get you the prize or not, I wouldn't use it. It's my best guess at it, and others who have worked on it. And it seems logical to me, considering everything. So 24, now his, Jacob's first daughter, having become sexually mature, Dinah, then, quote, went out to visit the daughters of the land, Yassah, Lamed, Ra'ah, Bet, Bath, Eretz. 25, the Hebrew verbs Yassah, went out, and then Ra'ah, to visit or see, are placed forward and at the end, respectively, in the sentence for emphasis, as I pointed out in our parsing. And she went out, Dinah, the daughter of Leah. Then ending the verse, to visit the daughters of the land. So they're placed forward and in, respectively, in the sentence. And that's for emphasis. The author wants to capture our attention. 26, that is, she left the house, went out, for the particular purpose to consort, to visit, with negative Canaanite women. She's going to go out and run with the Hivites, the Shechemites, those of the city of Shechem, the Canaanites. 27, this is the same ilk of negative volition, females, that Abraham and Isaac were adamant about not letting them be bound in marriage to their sons. Abraham and Isaac both said, no way, stay away from this population in regards to intermarrying. As we saw, remembering back with Abraham and his slave, well, you know, if she fails to come back, if we can't find someone, should I bring somebody back? No, don't do it. You know, that idea, 24:3. And he makes very clear, I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, he shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. I think he's pretty serious about that one. No. None. See. And then, in Isaac's case, 28:1-8, as he
He finally gets his act back together after Jacob deceives him. Isaac called Jacob, and his wife manipulated him and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." Repeated again the idea in verse 6. Ending in verse 6, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan," rather from their relatives in Haran, Padam Aram. And then also verse 8, "So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan displeased his father Isaac."
Negative volition. So this is whom the patriarchs, earlier patriarchs, were adding about, you don't want to get close to these people. Now Jacob's already settled down right next door to them. So 28, we are not to conclude here now for reference that Dinah ventured out across the land as one might take. She went out to visit the daughters of the land, like somehow she went out through all Canaan, going to visit the entire state. No. We're not to conclude that Dinah ventured out across the land of Canaan on her own, but that she went to the nearby town of Shechem where they lived. So she's just going into town, so to speak, not far, comparatively speaking, from where Jacob had his business and set up camp and bought the parcel of land in that area. So she's just going to go in and party down for whatever amount of time, basically. 29, whether she had Jacob's permission to go or not is not stated. The narrative leaves that blank. What initiated all this? Why did she do this? Etc. Well, understanding that separation underwrites, the doctrine of separation underwrites this, we can bring to conclusion what is being expressed here in this silence. That is 30, this to teach that violation of separation pertaining to parents and children is a two-way street. That is, obviously, you can have rebellion by the child. The parent might say, well, no, you don't hang out. The child rebels. They get old enough age, sneak out, whatever, you know. Or failure to enforce the doctrine by the parent on the other end of the coin. The parent's just liberal. They don't care. Yeah, I'll go hang out with your cosmic friends. Or both. You could have that situation. So there is no particular blame pointed either direction, recognizing that in this case, you probably have violation on both sides of the coin. Both of them. Both of them are guilty, so to speak, while the parent may not strictly enforce separation. The child here, Dinah, her brothers, they had the doctrine. They had the doctrine. It's not like Simeon and Levi and all they do, that they do this ignorant of doctrine. They know doctrine. They're familiar that they're part of the Abrahamic covenant. See? Now you don't want to capitulate to those kinds of excuses either. You know, I've heard that before, you know. Well, the pastor needs to hammer on this because some sin's going around the church or whatever. Like he had never taught it before. Like these people are ignorant. You know, fornicating is a sin. Now, how many times am I going to have to say that? Anything, sex outside of marriage is a sin. People have the doctrine. It's just the SCA rebels against it. See? Whatever, you know, you pick it. But obviously, since we're dealing with sexual sin here, we'll use it. So there's a responsibility on those otherwise children, even though their parents may be liberal and not want to follow doctrine, doesn't mean that you can't follow doctrine, that you have to succumb to it. Yeah, the preferred way is everybody to be on board. But that's not the way it always is. I've known people that had parents, and they were put in a position where their parents, you know, they started on doctrine by themselves, and parents were not only not interested, but they started yelling at them, telling them they couldn't go to Bible class. Then they permitted, let them have tapes, you know. So you're in your parents' authority. All right, well, God's still in control. They got tapes and listened, and then after a while, the parents caved in, whatever God did in their life. You know, that person's still on doctrine. There's your positive volition right there. So, you know, you can do what's right, whether everybody else around you doesn't or not. That's the idea. So 31, now Dinah would be at the female age when the hormones start making some, quote, boy crazy, end quote. Now our society today, everything's the male's fault anymore, basically. I'm not everything, but a lot of it points that direction. Yeah, let the women walk around acting like sluts, dressing like sluts. And you wonder why you have all the adverse activity that goes on in regards to society. Now, where's those parents? Where's the mother that lets her daughter dress like that? And again, it doesn't mean that gives the guy any excuse otherwise. Here, guy, control yourself. Good grief. So, you know. What do I need to say? I mean, is this doctrine so complicated, you know, I need to teach 20 classes on it? No. So, this kind of stuff comes out of this chapter. It's these kind of principles. Those principles that otherwise you're not going to see very often in the Scripture. But even though we may exhort on them otherwise in an offhanded way concerning certain doctrines as examples. And here we have these examples. So Dinah, she's at that age. She's boy crazy. Flirtatious. The least you can do as parents, warn your children. You act this way, you never know what may happen. Thirty-two. Whatever the driving force, being at home with her brothers all the time, obviously became boring. That wasn't enough for her. Who wants to go out and shepherd sheep? Take care of the farm, take care of the ranch. That's not enough. Round all her older brothers all the time. And she felt the need to explore the world. I need to go in town and educate myself. See what's out there in the world on my own. Educate yourself with the ways of the world, see. That's the excuse given often. And you got to realize that she's still under her parents' authority. She's still living under their roof. She's not on her own. She hasn't moved out of the house. See, you move out of the house, well, then God can deal with you personally. But she has parents that are supposed to be taking responsibility in this regard. So, the excuse, well, you know, you need to get out in the world, you need to give me a break. Now, that's one of the screwy things about the Amish culture, that it's hard to understand why they want their kids to go out and explore the world to see if they come back. What kind of attitude is that? You know, if you don't want doctrine, you can come to that decision on your own and just move out. You don't have to go out and explore the world to figure these things out. Anyway, you know. 33, Jacob's lack now as the parent, as the head of the house. Jacob's lack of any apparent righteous indignation after the fact. That's one of the things we're going to see here. The news comes back that his daughter gets raped. And you would think, man, he would fly off the handle. than not Jacob. He's just, So Jacob's lack of any apparent righteous indignation after the fact, as we will see in verse 5, Jacob had heard that he, Shechem, had defiled Dinah and his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. Jacob the procrastinator, man, that's one of the things that he does. So his apparent lack of apparent righteous indignation after the fact, and there's a time for anger, and obviously this would be when a crime has been committed, a heinous crime. And you would think a parent, again, would put it in first gear and take off tire squealing to deal with this matter. So that itself, continuing point 33, suggests a father that held priorities above the affairs of his daughter, and at the least did not vigorously enforce the doctrine of separation in his household. A lackadaisical attitude, basically. And as I'll bring out, when you tie verses together and what is ultimately said by Jacob later on, we'll see, once again with Jacob, his fear. Here, his reputation, as well as you know, what might happen to the family otherwise. So 34, any innocence that, if you want to, you can say any excuse people want to give in regards to her going into town, any innocence that might be attributed to the actions of Dinah in rationalization otherwise is quickly spoiled then in verse 2. Whatever excuse you want to give, well, that's all right for her to go into town. This just shouldn't have happened. Well, guess what? It happened. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and he raped her by force. Wow, Ra'ah, Eth, Shechem, Ben, Hamor, Ha, Hivite, Nasi, Ha, Eris, Wow, Lakak, Eth, Wow, Shechab, Eth, Wow, Anah. So with that upbeat note, we'll pick it up Tuesday evening. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to utilize these things in Jesus' name. Amen.